Welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Han, and with the Tories moving ever more to the right while Labour moves left, there's been a lot of talk about whether the UK needs a new party, sort of an answer to Emmanuel Macron's En Marche. Renew Britain wants to be exactly that party. Founded in 2017, it hopes to occupy the abandoned centre ground in UK politics and represent all of those who feel like picking between red and blue is essentially like being stuck between a rock and a hard place. What exactly does the party stand for and what are its chances of success? We talked to James Torrens about how he went from accountant to independent candidate in the 2017 election to co-founder of Renew. And of course, we also discussed the ever-present elephant in the room, Brexit. James Ryan is an anti-Brexit candidate and stopping Brexit is one of Renew's core goals. But why and how do they plan to go about it? Stay tuned to find out all about that, and while you're here, please do subscribe to us wherever you're listening and let us know your thoughts on this or any other episode. We're at Brexit Podcast on all social media or at brexitpodcast.com. Now, you were originally an accountant from London. What encouraged you to run as an anti-Brexit candidate in the 2017 general election?
Well, I think I basically looked around when the election was announced. I looked around at candidates that I might have to vote for. And I very much felt that there were very few candidates who really I could get excited about voting for. And I was quite hacked off with the MP in my constituency at the time, who, despite the fact that the constituency had voted almost 70% to remain in the EU, was quite a committed hard Brexiteer, in a way that she kind of hadn't entirely been open about at the 2015 election. And I felt that was pretty, you know, unappealing. And I thought that I wanted a candidate who would give her a challenge or make life difficult for her, at least, and would make the Tories realise that there was an electoral cost to the approach they were taking on Brexit. And given that I didn't think there were any other kind of solid candidates that I could get excited about, I thought I had a choice between either kind of spending the election kind of watching from my sofa and shouting at the TV every now and then, or I could get involved, and then at least I could say, you know, I had somebody to vote for at the end of the day, even if nobody else did.
And why run as an independent?
Well, to put bluntly, there wasn't another party I could really get on board with. Obviously, a lot of people say to us, why don't you just kind of make your peace with the Liberal Democrats and join them? But I very much felt that they were, as a group, kind of fatally divided and tainted by their time in coalition and obviously by tuition fees, which was quite a big issue for me personally. And so I thought, given the relatively short notice of the election, you might as well run as an independent and at least get involved and kind of have a go at giving people a proper alternative to vote for.
And you, if I am seeing this correctly, ran predominantly as a sort of anti-Brexit candidate. So can you talk to me a bit about why that was such a sort of cornerstone of your campaign?
Yeah, well, I think there are two principal reasons for that. One is just the urgency of it. It comes with a deadline that's approaching very quickly. So in terms of kind of thinking about problems that exist that we have to deal with now, we have to get the Brexit question right, and if we don't, we're going to pay for it in the future, and we have to get it right now, basically. So I think that's one reason why it was a big part. And the other thing is that I think a lot of other issues will flow from it. So I personally believe it's likely to be very damaging to the economy in the long run, which will put an enormous amount of pressure on public services, which are already massively under pressure, and that will in turn feed into many of the kind of existing injustices and inequalities that we see all over the country. We certainly see it in Kensington, where I was running, where there's massive inequalities, not just in income, but in things like life expectancy and things like that, just in one constituency. And so to an extent, it's one of the big problems that we face right now, from which many other problems will flow. And so that was one of the reasons why I think it was particularly important for me to highlight that. And kind of we need to deal with it now, basically.
You have also founded a new party called Renew Britain, which is sort of quite a centrist party, co-founded, that is. Are your feelings about Brexit partly the reason for you wanting to take that step, or why were you motivated in that way?
Again, I think it was the kind of absence of alternatives was a big part of it. And the extremity of the alternatives, because the way we kind of see it, the way Chris and I were looking at it when we were talking about setting up Renew, was, the Tory party has moved to the right with Brexit. They're more intolerant than they used to be. And they seem to be more focused on turning back the clock, and in many ways on setting up a kind of a much more closed society than we necessarily wanted to live in. And at the same time, the Labour Party have kind of drifted to their extreme on the left, largely because of Jeremy Corbyn. And so there was this kind of space in the middle where we were like, well, we probably sit in the centre between those two, but they're also very kind of slightly nationalist or closed parties, which we find very unappealing. And so I think Brexit was a big part of it, but it was more the political party's response to Brexit and the way they had reacted to it that really made us feel like actually we need an alternative voice. And I think connected to that, and probably connected to one of the reasons why I ran in Kensington as an independent, was this feeling of complacency amongst so many politicians at the moment. There was certainly a feeling in Kensington of oh, well, everybody's always going to vote Tory, so we don't necessarily need to care about what people think or the way they react or whatever. We'll just take this constituency for granted and move on from there. And similarly, I think in the House of Commons as a whole, in politics as a whole, there is this sense that there are these established parties that are very comfortable in their positions at the moment. They feel that, it's either going to be us or it's going to be them, and we'll have an argument between ourselves about it, but we don't actually have to recruit inspiring candidates or anything like that, because we have quite a privileged position in society. And I think we quite wanted to challenge that and make them really think about how to offer a better alternative to the people of Britain.
So how did you get to that place? Because that seems like quite an overwhelming sort of system to be faced with disrupting. How do you go from being an accountant in London to saying, I'm going to set up an entirely new party in what is essentially a two-party system that's been ingrained like this for so long?
Yeah, it's a pretty daunting proposition. And I think the answer to your question is we go one step at a time, basically. One of the big moments in the election was discovering that not only that Chris was running, but that there are several other independent candidates in London who basically had a very similar reaction to me when the election was announced, and had all kind of set up in their own constituencies and run as independents. And I think we ended up with a group of four of us who kind of tried to start working together in different constituencies to get a little bit more profile during the election. And we kind of looked around and went, well, if four of us have come to this opinion completely independently, then there must be others. There must be other people who would feel this way. And also the reaction that we got on the campaign trail, there were a lot of people who were really encouraging about what we were trying to do. And then I suppose kind of Chris was a massive driving force, because he very much started his campaign on the basis of he thinks there needed to be a new party, and he was running on that kind of platform. And kind of once we got together and started talking about it, you say, well, the only way to guarantee that it will fail is not to try to do it. And so we got a group together, and then you plot out a course to how do you go from where we were immediately after the election as just a couple of guys in a pub, basically, to building a party. And we always said that what we wanted to do was recruit candidates, and we'd found a couple of donors who were willing to to support that process. So we said, okay, we'll give it till kind of September, October time, see what kind of response we got. And we've been getting a really good response so far. We're up to about 130 candidates recruited, I think, with another kind of 150 or so in the pipeline. So we're moved well on our way to our target of getting, you know, 650 candidates to stand in every seat in at the next general election. It's very much bit by bit. You kind of we'll you know, move on each phase at a time, each stage, and hopefully one day we'll be in a position to really challenge the Tories and Labour, basically.
From what I've sort of gained from your website, you're very intent on having those members of your party, those representatives, be very much ordinary people, very much not career politicians. How do you go about finding them? Why is that important to you? And then, quite a big one, how do you go about convincing them that it's a possibility even to run? Because I don't think a lot of people are very opinionated politically, but it would never cross their mind to even run for any kind of office because they think they're not informed enough about the process or something like that.
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge for us. We've been using a lot of social media to try and get the message out, and also to kind of to make sure we get as diverse a group of candidates as possible. One of the things we're aware of at the moment is kind of, you know, we kind of, Chris and I both live in London, and the team kind of started in London. So we are initially a relatively London focused group, but we don't want to be. So we're starting the process of basically going out around the country and trying to engage people. And that will be a combination of gathering our supporters together who've read about us or heard about us one way or another in different parts of the country, but also just, you know, basic kind of wearing down the shoe leather and standing around in the street pretty much saying, you know, trying to engage people and talk to people. It's something that kind of Emmanuel Macron did in France when he kind of launched En Marche. He did his Grand Marche across the country where he kind of launched this massive survey run by volunteers. And I think that's something that we'd really like to emulate. But once you are talking to people, kind of, I think just the fact of existing as a party and the fact that there is somebody speaking to people who feel the same way as us, saying there is an alternative, this is our plan to get there, can be quite a motivating force when we encounter people who are considering being candidates, basically.
So where is it you're trying to get to, I suppose? So you're talking about occupying this sort of deserted centre ground. What does that look like in practice for you? What does Renew stand for?
So we basically believe very much in opportunity. And when we say that, we mean kind of finding or guaranteeing opportunities for everybody in the country. We think that that kind of is, I think that a life without opportunities, the sense that people don't have opportunities, is one of the biggest driving forces of dissatisfaction in the country at the moment and dissatisfaction with politics. We think that there are too many people out there who feel that one way or another that the system is rigged against them, or that the kind of their chance at building a life for themselves has passed them by, or was something they were robbed of early on. And so we stand for very much setting up a country in which people feel that there are opportunities available to them, and in which they can kind of pursue their own dreams relatively freely. And what that means is that you need to set up a number of things around that. So you need to have a strong economy, which we think is very important. It's a kind of, if you don't have a growing economy, it's very difficult to provide the opportunities that you need for people coming through. But you also need to set up a number of other things that kind of provide protection to people and look after people. So you need a functioning welfare state, and you need to you know, guarantee things like a functioning health service as well. There's no point saying, oh, well, you can go off and do this, that and the other if people are worried about getting sick all the time. So for us, it's about creating that kind of stable environment, a strong economy, and functioning public services, basically. But we think there are also a number of other things that are connected to that. So one of the big distortions in the economy that we see at the moment is housing, where you've got young people who are either kind of completely barred from the housing market altogether and destined to spend ever-increasing proportions of their income on housing, usually in the private rented sector, which we think is quite negative. But you also have this kind of collective, not necessarily psychosis, but you know, everybody is so obsessed with getting on the housing ladder or trying to pay for that, that that distorts other decisions in the economy that we think is very negative. So we think we have to deal with that as a priority as well, principally by building more houses, but also by addressing the other distortion in the economy, which is the kind of north-south divide, the fact that London is such a predominant part of the economy, and there isn't a kind of competing alternative anywhere else in the country, largely because of neglect. And we think that, again, is very negative. It's like, you know, London is one of the most expensive places in the world to live and work. And that's, you know, and there aren't jobs available necessarily in the rest of the country. And we think that that needs to be corrected, basically.
So this creating of opportunities, is that where Brexit to you comes in as well? Is that your motivation for wanting to reverse it?
Yeah, I think one of the truths of Brexit is that it will rob many people of many opportunities over the coming decades, basically. And it will consistently do that kind of the longer it goes on. Not only in terms of kind of the traditional or basic kind of what's the economy going to look like, but also in terms of, you know, how do we, you know, do people have the opportunity to live and work and study abroad in the European Union? Do they have the opportunity to join things like the European Youth Orchestra and all those kind of things, which provide fantastic opportunities for young people at the moment, but have been wildly overlooked in the debate around Europe? And I think because it is going to do so much harm to the economy, it will be very tough then after Brexit to provide the kind of the level of opportunity that we think we need in this country in order to kind of improve people's lives, basically.
So how in practice would Renew want to bring about sort of, is it about bringing around a second referendum? Is that the idea?
So I think there's two levels to it. Because obviously we have to be realistic about the fact that the clock is ticking. I think at the moment, if we don't have a general election in the next 18 months, then a second referendum is basically the only way to achieve what we're looking for. We think that the steps to get there are basically to put sufficient pressure on MPs and the government for them to feel that they can't push through any kind of Brexit without the assent of the population. So they will have to make very significant compromises, particularly compared to the things that the Leave campaign promised during the referendum. And I think we need to remind them that they will be held to account for those promises. And if the current crop of MPs pursue a course that has very long-term implications for the economy and very negative implications for the economy, the next time they are up for election, they will get punished at the ballot box. And I think the only way out for them in that will be to have a second referendum and to get the assent of the British people in that process. And once you are having a second referendum, I think we have to put a lot of pressure on to make sure that remaining in the EU is on the ballot. And I don't think that's a wildly unrealistic kind of state of affairs for us to get to in the next 18 months. But then there is the other possibility that that the government collapses and that one way or another there is an election. And we very much want to be ready for that. And I think if there was an election, we would stand on the platform of stopping Brexit there and then. And that would be, you know, it would be the British people's opportunity to vote on that as well.
So say a second referendum did happen, how do you see the chances of people actually voting to remain in the EU?
I think they're very strong. I think you're seeing at the moment the ground is shifting in terms of seeing, I think majority of people think leaving the EU was a bad idea for the first time. Majority of people now think we're going to be worse off economically outside the EU than inside. And that kind of process is ongoing. I think every month it goes on, that proportion of people gets higher. I think also, you know, if there is a second referendum, then there will be something tangible on the table from the Brexiteers. They won't be able to not just peddle the lies that they did peddle, but kind of make the case in the way that they did, which was to say, oh, you know, you can have your cake and eat it. People will be very kind of will be realizing, actually, you know, it's not possible to have completely free access to the single market and also not have freedom of movement and also be completely free of the jurisdiction of the ECJ and be able to sign our own customs agreement. Like that's not a realistic option, and so it won't be on the table. And I think when people realise that the compromises that the Brexit camp are going to be forced to make, I think they'll say, well, given a choice between that set of compromises and being in the EU, we might as well just stay in the EU. Like the pain fundamentally isn't worth it. It shouldn't be.
I think I've touched on this on the podcast before, so apologies to anyone listening if you've heard me rant about this already, but I'm personally a bit concerned that, say, a second referendum did happen, I feel like this would cause even more division and even more polarization than there already is in this country, because the people who initially voted to leave will feel like their democratic vote has been taken away, and the people who voted to remain will feel sort of emboldened in their views, and there will just be more of an entrenched difference rather than sort of a coming together of saying, like, oh, maybe that wasn't the best idea. Are you at all concerned about that?
Yeah, I think that is a concern, and I think in a way it's incumbent on Remainers to be honest about the result of the referendum last time around and say, 52% of the population had some really serious concerns, and they need to be listened to, and they need to be kind of taken into account and addressed. I personally, and one of the reasons why I feel particularly strongly about it is because I think those concerns are real and they exist, but they will not at all be helped or addressed by leaving the European Union. So after Brexit, you'll be left with a bunch of people who voted to leave because they had, they're facing a number of issues in their lives, a number of issues in their communities, which should not be ignored, but nothing will have got better. In fact, everything will have got worse. And I think that will be divisive. But I think if we have a second referendum, you know, if you're part of the Remain campaign, you have to be saying, actually, setting out a positive vision for how Britain or the UK remaining in the EU will start to address the concerns that people have. So, for example, you know, a big concern that came up in the referendum, that came up in the election campaign, is around what is the impact of immigration on wages, public services and housing. I personally think immigration is a positive force, but that there are some people who do suffer from it. And by and large, those people are at the lower end of the income spectrum. And the people who really benefit from it, by and large, are at the higher end of the income spectrum. And we need to be open about that and to address it properly with new policies and new solutions. And that's something that current politicians haven't been honest about at all. And I think will be one of the things that will help to draw the country together if you did have a second referendum.
What would a solution like that look like, though, assuming that sort of you get your wish and we have a second referendum and we remain in the EU? How do you consolidate the EU's freedom of movement and, on the other hand, instating some kind of regulation, I suppose, on immigration to help equalise who it affects in our society?
So I'm not certain that it's necessarily about regulating immigration itself, but it's about addressing the effects of immigration. So I think it'd be perfectly reasonable, for example, to say there are some communities where you've had very significant changes in the distribution of the population as a result of immigration. And that has an effect on local public services, particularly schools, for example. And so you can kind of, you can start to address it by saying, okay, the government is going to say, on the whole, we benefit from immigration, but these communities incur additional costs, and therefore we're going to have additional funding to schools in areas with high levels of immigration, for example, so that the people who are in some of those communities both see, you know, they see the immigration, but they see the benefits that come with it. And that's things like some things like that have happened in Italy, for example, where communities that take in refugees have had kind of direct support from the central government. And that has massively increased the popularity of immigration in those areas. And I think it's policies like that we can start to use to say, actually, we're going to spread the benefits of immigration to account for the costs that you incur as well. I think also, like, modern politicians have had a free ride on the back of many immigrants. They've been very willing to have a go at them, to insult them on the basis that, you know, well, they don't vote, so they're a pretty easy whipping boy. And I think you also have to stop that, because the more you say it, the more people believe it's true. And that's I think a negative force that has happened.
So where would the money for those kinds of policies come from?
So on one level, you kind of, this is where economic growth becomes really, really important. The reality of the last 10 years has been that economic growth has been consistently lower than it's needed to be, partly because of government actions, partly because of the rest of the world economy. And I think we can say, listen, like, let's actually focus on doing the things we need to boost growth. So let's not do harmful things like leaving the European Union. And that will generate dividends in and of itself. I think there is probably an additional thing that we're saying at the moment, you know, part of the pressure on public finances is because of the Conservatives' attitude to it, in that they are very, very attached to this idea of running surplus by the, you know, early mid-2020s, which may or may not be, well, personally, I don't think it's necessarily the best economics in the world. There's nothing magic about having a surplus that kind of generates any massive economic dividends. If you do have too much austerity, you end up with negative economic consequences like Brexit, basically. So I think there's part of that as well. And I think there is also a sense of that there may need to be small tax rises in the short term. So I think kind of the government's planning to cut corporation tax again down to 17%, I think, which is one of those measures which the business world isn't clamouring for. They'll take it. You know, everybody will take a tax cut if you offer it to them. But is it the most important thing in the economy at the moment? Almost certainly not. Is it, you know, going to cost the government a lot of money? Almost certainly. So kind of, you know, is it the best idea in the world? I personally don't think so.
Perhaps because of this economic optimism that Renew has, you've been compared quite a lot to, as you talked about earlier, Emmanuel Macron's Al Marché. So do you think that Renew has a similar chance of success, I suppose, considering that the English are typically a bit more reserved with their politics, a little less revolution prone, and considering as well that, you know, the UK has a very different constitution, a very different voting system, do you think it would allow for something like Al Marché to happen?
Yes, I think obviously it has to happen differently, because, you know, we don't have the opportunity of a kind of single presidential election to pursue, and also because of the kind of distorting effect of Marine Le Pen in France, you can kind of you don't have to come first in France in order to win the election necessarily, but I think. The challenge in the UK is to is to become part of the public discussion, basically, and we're at the very beginning of that. And we think that once that happens, we actually have quite an appealing message to people. We're not extremists. We are open and positive about the future in a way that neither of the main parties are. And we think that, you know, we have a plan to deliver on that positivity. And I think once you start getting into that discussion, the British people will be kind of receptive to it. I have faith in them in that respect.
On your website, it says that you want to establish Britain as the innovation superpower that overcomes the great challenges of the 21st century to achieve peace and prosperity for all in this generation, that we revolutionise opportunity at home, end global extreme poverty, and save the planet. That seems like a very lofty goal. How do you plan to go about that?
Yeah, it's one of the, we talk about it internally, we describe it as a BHAG. It's a big, hairy, audacious goal, I think. And I think you have to be, you know, we said at the beginning, we were like, do we downplay this? Do we say we just want to be a pressure group? And we said, no, we want to achieve great things. And one of the things that we really do believe is that this country and the world faces some huge challenges at the moment, whether it is global poverty, whether it is climate change and the impact that that is going to have on global poverty, or whether it's the kind of domestic inequalities that we're seeing at the moment, the distortions in the economy. And we think those are very significant challenges, but we have huge opportunities to address them. And I think they are connected with innovation, with investment in technology, and with research and development. So if you look at the kind of the work that's gone on in green technologies just in the last kind of 15 or 20 years, where kind of renewable energy as a proportion of the kind of the UK's energy mix and other countries' energy mixes has rocketed massively. So you're starting to get countries like Denmark and Germany who are, you know, running for days on purely renewable energy, which is an extraordinary achievement. And the UK energy renewable energy mix is going up massively, which is having an impact on our ability to reduce carbon emissions. And at the same time, those are brand new industries, right? So if you can become leaders in those industries that have both kind of a positive environmental impact and a positive economic impact, then you start to get they're mutually reinforcing, and you start to get huge benefits that flow from that. We think those are opportunities we can be at the centre of and take advantage of. And if we capitalise on them, you do start to address some of those really big challenges that we outline. And that would be great. You know, humanity in many ways has an opportunity in the 21st century to be, in the same way that the generation following the Second World War managed to largely, you know, be the generation that avoided huge armed conflicts between massive nation states. I think we have an opportunity to be the generation that addresses, you know, some of the huge challenges that have developed from humanity's growth and humanity's impact on its environment and on the rest of the world.
I think that is a very nice and optimistic note to end this on. Thank you again so much for joining us, James.
No worries. Thank you very much.
That's it for today's episode. Thanks as always for tuning in, and there are new episodes of the podcast every Tuesday and Thursday, so if you want to get those and stay up to date on all the Brexit news and opinions of the day, please do subscribe to us wherever you're listening right now, and that way you can get them sent straight to your phone. You can also find us pretty much anywhere at Brexit Podcast, and the show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, Ollie Dugmore and Warren Paul, with a theme song by Kevin MacLeod.